I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. We'll begin this hour with a quote from columnist Hal Crowther on the subject of an endangered free press. He writes, "Here in the United States, we're in the process of inventing silence without fear. Money, the profit motive, the bottom line, unchecked capitalism, greed, whatever you choose to call it, is shutting down the machinery of the free press more effectively than censors or secret police." That's from a 1988 column by Hal Crowther. Our guest today on Conversations is what he calls a professionally anointed media critic and a voice at large, syndicated in over 50 newspapers in the United States. We'll hear his thoughts in the next hour on the media, on politics, and on the state of the democracy. Hal, I want to look back before we come to the present. You've written in another column that the Fourth Estate was once a power to be reckoned with, what you called a great power in the world. Talk to me about that time, the when and how and what of it, and then we'll talk a little more about the Fourth Estate.
Well, I think at one time in this country, the people who were working in newspapers back, this is of course back before the electronic media were on the scene, tended to be a little more sophisticated in many ways than the politicians and the people, you know, the businessmen and so on that they were dealing with. They had a certain advantage, and their attitude was usually one of considerable skepticism toward officialdom of all kinds. And because of the kind of profession that journalism had become in this country, the tradition of the 19th century was really a highly competitive system where each city had four or five newspapers, and each one was competing to be the most interesting newspaper and the one that would, you know, dig up the most exciting things that were happening and topple politicians and businessmen who were crooked and so forth. And it was a real strong, equal sort of situation between the, quote, free press and the people who were working to get away with something. And over the years, of course, I think that that situation has tilted the other way. I think that balance, which was once on the side of journalists, has tipped over to the people who have been their traditional adversaries.
You said that when you were in school, you were in school, among others, under Fred Friendly, 50 years in the business, starting with Edward R. Murrow at CBS.
That's right. I don't think the business even goes back 50 years.
But he
started
Fred
was
radio,
there at the beginning anyway.
Right.
He was in radio in the early 50s.
He said, you said of him that he always encouraged you to be cynical and hard-boiled. Is that the condition you see historically in the press in the United States that has disappeared?
I think that's the difference. I mean, when Fred and Murrow and these people first understood, you know, what they had with television, the power that they had, they were real journalists from other media, you know, from newspapers and from the radio, who had this really strong crusading idea, and they were just delighted with this new toy. And they had people like Bill Paley, the president of CBS and so forth, who were, you know, although if you read their biographies and you find they weren't really very admirable individuals, they also were much taken with their own power and their possibilities of changing, molding the world, throwing their weight around in the world. They weren't primarily interested in making profits. I mean, that was sort of a secondary thing. As a matter of fact, originally, the idea was that the news would be a very expensive throwaway, like a loss leader. They would, you know, no one even thought about making money off the news until the 70s. This is a thing that people don't seem to realize. I mean, news was a thing that you did to show your appreciation for all the money that you were making with this terrible programming you were doing and the advertising that you sold with it. And you gave that one thing back. There used to be this idea, also forgotten, that the Federal Communications Commission believed that the airwaves, well, actually our statutes say that the airwaves belong to the people. I mean, there are airwaves, and we supposedly lease them to these people. And once upon a time, there was a considerable sensitivity to that among broadcasters, and the idea that, you know, we are very fortunate to have this license, and we have to give something back to the people. And what they wanted to give back was a really strong kind of news presence, you know, a real strong analytical, investigative, documentary presence. And some wonderful things have happened and were happening until other factors in the marketplace sort of, you know, put these journalists in the position of being slowly starved out, which is what we have today. I mean, which I suppose we're going to try to trace, which I have traced many times in my in my writing.
And I think we'll be trying to do that in the next hour as well. Mm-hmm. A bit of an introduction. Hal Crowther graduated with graduate degrees both from Harvard and Columbia School of Journalism in English and in journalism. Columbia graduated from in 1967. He is a columnist. As I mentioned, his column carried in between 50 and 60 weeklies, mostly around the southern states of the United States. He writes one essay a week, and in his words, is licensed to shoot at anyone, the subject of politics, philosophy, religion, the media, and more. Hal Crowther, our guest today on Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes. I want to, without asking a question that feels too ridiculously ignorant, ask you to talk to me about the importance of a free press in a democracy. Ben Bagdikian wrote in his book, The Media Monopoly, that diversity of expression is assumed to be the natural state of an enduring liberty. If you can kind of take off from that thought, give me your thoughts on the importance of a free press.
Well, information is probably more precious today as just an entity than it ever has been before, because it's so complex and because there are so many people who are attempting to manipulate information and communications and so on for certain purposes, for power, for commercial gain. And there's only traditionally one voice that supposedly is doing, is handling information in an altruistic, objective way, and that was allegedly our free press. But now that we have tremendous industries involved in advertising and public relations, and the government and the companies, the corporations that in many cases control the government, they have become tremendously sophisticated in bringing their message to the people. I mean, sophisticated almost beyond belief. I mean, there are whole new sciences, really, of public relations and advertising and so on that have evolved just in the last few years. And of course, television is their natural medium. Mm-hmm. Television, which is has this immediacy, this visual quality. You can get people to respond to symbols that are pre-verbal. You know, I mean, the way they sell Coca-Cola with sex, and things that connect only in your mind. You know, you have associations with certain things and intellectually there's no connection, but they have learned how to make connections. And so if you have the individual consumer, you or me, we're just being bombarded with these messages that all have a certain purpose. And you could say we're being bombarded with messages that are deliberate lies or distortions. We're constantly being pushed and pulled by people who have a message, have something they want to do with us, not usually for our good, but for their good. And the only people traditionally equipped to help you sort this out and to blow the whistle when it becomes impossibly offensive and dangerous was the free press. These people had this vocation at one time, and I think still with people like the best professors I ever had this really holy sense of a mission. I mean, certainly Fred Friendly, whom you mentioned, Fred used to preach what we called, the gospel according to Murrow.
And, Edward R. Murrow.
Right, and Edward R. Murrow, who was his colleague in those early broadcasts. But he just had this idea that it was really a critical thing for the press to remain independent and to remain strong and to keep recruiting good people and paying them well and increasing their influence, because he knew well enough, having been at the power center for so many years in industry and politics and so forth, that those other people are tremendously clever, gaining strength, gaining technical knowledge all the time, and there was just really no one left. People were swallowing messages all the time that were pernicious and not understanding what they were swallowing. So, it's really an antidote to becoming a treadmill animal, someone who is just a consumer who consumes information programmed by other people and responds in programmed ways.
Why hasn't the press become sophisticated along with Madison Avenue and along with the White House?
Well, the press has become sophisticated in a lot of ways, but the balance of power turned at a certain point. It turned, first of all, I think, when broadcasting became a more important form than print. All of a sudden, you had people who were talented who were upward mobile journalists who were more interested in becoming, if you will, stars, personalities themselves, becoming big players, you know, rather than the traditional journalist is the guy on the edge of the crowd taking notes and kind of grinning at, you know, at the foolishness that he's seeing from a distance. But now you had a lot of the big talent eager to get in there and become celebrities, become important players themselves. And I think that began the change. All of a sudden, instead of wanting to be an investigative reporter and winning a Pulitzer Prize, people wanted to be an anchor man on CBS News. And of course, you know, being an anchor man in CBS News is not at this moment, and certainly not in the future, going to be a journalist's job at all. You know, it's something more like being a host on Today.
A reader,
and a personality. Someone, and a person who filters the news, if you will, through a certain aura of importance, of self-importance. And the second wave, I think, after the networks and the broadcasters took control, gained most of the advertising, most of the power, most of the interest, and people began to be retooled from a nation of readers to a nation of watchers, of people who watch this tube. And all of a sudden, it all swung toward the possibility of making enormous amounts of money with this medium. And slowly but surely, the old owners, the people like General Sarnoff and Frank Stanton and Bill Paley and so the ones who started these networks, they were replaced by younger people who were from companies that weren't essentially broadcasters. I mean, they were from companies that sold light bulbs or
Kleenex,
you know, general
cars.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you read the Media Monopoly, Bagdikian's book, you know that the conglomerates that own most of our media companies own everything imaginable. I mean, defense contractors, plastics, oil, almost all the things that seriously pollute the environment, and, you know, lumber companies and so forth. And, you know, they're not broadcasters in the sense that these old, we can think of them as robber barons, but these people like Henry Luce and Bill Paley and so forth, these people were much more interested in power and manipulation and getting their people elected and so forth than they were in the bottom line. And once the bottom line took over, you had a rapid decline in the quality of television journalism, broadcasting journalism of all kinds, and you had an equal sort of fall off in morale in the part of the print journalists who saw themselves being really the increase of the big media conglomerates meant that, say, a chain of 70 papers used to mean there were 70 labor reporters. But now you have one in Washington, and his column goes to 70 papers. So there are fewer jobs, less money, less interest. And a lot of the best people, frankly, didn't go into the profession. And you now have a situation, I mean, this is telling a whole story and going a little bit ahead, but you have a situation where people who are, I think, essentially more intelligent and better educated are in the business of fooling journalists. I mean, in other words, there are a lot of journalists who finished lower in their classes in journalism school than the people who were hired by the White House and by Procter & Gamble in order to fool them. And this is an unusual change of power.
This is Conversations. You're listening to Hal Crowther. Bagdikian wrote in 1980, when Media Monopoly in its first edition came out, that 50 major corporations then owned the rights to essentially the majority of the mass media in this United States. By 1987, when the second edition came out, it was down to 27 corporations.
Dramatic reduction.
The impact is not always obvious of this reduction of ownership. Can you think aloud for us on that subject?
Well, it doesn't necessarily always translate into people trying to manipulate what is actually on the news. What it is, it's an allocation of resources. And the best possible example would be NBC Television, which was purchased by General Electric. Since a friend of mine was pretty high in the sales department at NBC, I've heard all this from the inside. And all these people understood about broadcasting as, well, we have this new division NBC, and by God, they're going to carry their weight, the same as coaxial cables and light bulbs and whatever else that General Electric is selling. Well, defense contracts, you know, that was their main industry at that time. I guess Westinghouse no longer even makes light bulbs, right? They do nothing except defense contracts. But all of a sudden, there were people there who didn't understand that it was supposed to be some sort of a slightly special vocation, that there was a mission involved. And the resources simply dried up. They were saying, well, if you can't make a certain profit, then we are not going to put any more money into these losing operations. Things like documentaries, which are enormously expensive, also happen to be the thing that television does best of all. I mean, if you looked at all the finest things that have ever been on the television screen since the invention of the medium, there would be just one wonderful documentary after another. And at least one of the networks is completely out of the business of documentaries, doesn't do any. That would be NBC. And I think the other two have cut them way back. CBS has cut them almost to the point where one a year or something. And the reason is that the people who run these companies at a certain level are not interested in the difficult money-losing side of journalism. They are interested in the simplest thing of all, which is to put, you know, an attractive man on one side of the desk, an attractive woman on the other side, find out what their Q rating is, which means how people respond to them, and run the most inexpensive news operation that they can behind these faces that people tune into because they trust them, react to them, desire them sexually, whatever. That's cheap. That's cheap news. And at this very moment, they're closing their bureaus all over the world. They're taking feeds from one bureau where they used to have six on the spot, and basically they're trying to get as much as they can out of these operations. So in other words, it's not. And when this happens, of course, you know, it isn't that somebody sitting in the CEO's desk at General Electric says, you know, I will keep. I can't even think who's the anchor man now on NBC. But it's not that I will keep this man from saying this or that. What they do is they squeeze off the ability of the people sitting in those chairs to say anything creative, original, or worth hearing while all the stories go by.
And part of that is because Peter Jennings or Dan Rather or any of the people we see on the three major networks aren't getting the information from Afghanistan, Kuwait, from...
But you see how ridiculous the star system is with the salary of one of these anchor people who are basically, just stars, like Hollywood stars. With one of their salaries, they could open 10 new bureaus. I mean, it's, you know, and have real journalists out there getting real news. But that's not the way it works.
You have talked about what you call the toxic effects of TV on print. Does this have to do with what we call bits and bytes in this business, the rise of USA Today, as perhaps an example?
Yeah, I think very much so. I think that the attention span of the average American adult, average American child, even more so, each generation, I think, has a shorter attention span. I think they're used to that frenetic cut, 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 cut business that you see on network programs, but you also see now even more horribly in commercials. Since I was a television critic back in the 70s, I have not watched much television at all. I mean, almost nothing except sporting events. And when I see some of these commercials now, I was watching, I must have been baseball, I guess, last summer, and they put on these soft drink commercials. And the cutting was so fast. I mean, the image was on there such a short time. I think some of the messages were almost subliminal. I think I saw two naked people making love in the middle of a soft drink commercial. I think. I'm not sure, but maybe it was one of those images that they meant for you to say, whoa, what did I just see there? But not really be sure ever because it was so quick. But it almost made me dizzy to try to capture those images that were running by me so fast. And people's whole way of dealing with information has been speeded up to the level where they don't actually know most of the time exactly what they're hearing. I mean, it's sort of, you know, people's brains have speeded up to a certain extent, but not fast enough to really absorb the essence of whatever's being run by them. So you can cheat. You know, you can run things through that don't really have any message or any logical progression at all, but people are just taking bang, bang, one signal after another, and they don't even bother to sort it out anymore. And I think that, unfortunately, as people get used to this kind of image, this kind of message, they expect it in their reading material, which they're slowly abandoning, I'm afraid. But in a reading material in a publication like USA Today is programmed in exactly the same way. It's not only in little nuggets, like in News McNuggets, they call them. It's not only in tiny chunks, but it's also written in this absolutely homogenized style, and where it all seems the same. You know, almost no writers are allowed to show any style or any prejudice. It's just absolute computer printout kind of journalism.
Now, go back to the why writers wouldn't be allowed to show style or personality in their writing. Is that a product of, vertently or inadvertently?
Well, it takes time. The stuff that takes longer to write takes longer to read. Like, I use long sentences sometimes. I use very long sentences sometimes. And I do it almost deliberately. I use, fairly complex forms. I mean, I fool around with the syntax and so forth, partly because I want the people who read it to stop and pay attention to what I'm doing. You know, I use puns. I make allusions to literature and to history and so forth in ways that, I mean, I'm willing to go over the heads of some of my readers in order to please and to engage what I hope are my regular readers. And obviously, every survey shows that most people now don't want to fool with written material that's that complex. They want it straight up front, you know, like holding up a sign. And I think people who are entertaining to read are being eliminated, where they're down to maybe, I can think of five or six columnists, you know, who get by on style, just because they have a faithful group of people who like to read them, people like Russell Baker and Ellen Goodman, who have a strong personality and a strong style that attract people. Not sensation. Not people are looking for sensation or looking for gossip, but they feel as if they're in a conversation with these writers. But those writers are rapidly being eliminated from the mass media.
This is Conversations. You're listening to Hal Crowther. A little more information about Mr. Crowther. He went to work out of the Columbia School of Journalism for Time magazine in 1967. You may remember the People section in Time. He used to read it religiously. Hal Crowther wrote it in those days. In those days, he says, we wrote it with tongue in cheek, and then it got serious, and we couldn't write it anymore. He also wrote the Press section for Time, which is, I assume, your first bathing as a professionally anointed media critic. Was it that?
Yes,
point?
I think so. It was my first license, I guess, right, to criticize my colleagues.
After 4 or 5 years, he jumped over to Newsweek for media commentary from that seat. You have mentioned the manipulation of the media. I've always been interested in this title, this concept of spin doctor. We seem to have a lot of spin doctors around these days, both from corporations, from the White House, working fairly unabashedly in the nation. The reality and the consequence of spin doctors in our midst?
Well, it's that people begin to think that there is no such thing as the truth, that it's all a game. And I think there's a definite trend now in the polls that they take of people, that people don't think that there is someone somewhere who's just simply trying to tell them the truth. They think that everybody has an angle, mm-hmm, and everybody's trying to sell something, push something. I've had a problem with this myself when people call me and they want me to speak somewhere, and I say, well, what do you want me to speak about? I said, I'm not a Democrat, I'm not a Republican, I'm not selling anything. I don't have a pitch. I just write these things. I mean, I'm an observer, and it's sort of suspicious almost now to try to tell people that you're really not in anyone's camp, that you don't have a product, you don't have a line of goods that you're trying to sell to people. Because the whole thing now is this giant game, this sort of communications tug of war, where there's money and talent on one side and money and talent on the other side, and everybody is pulling for the attention of the audience and trying to get their particular version across. And people know that they've been fooled, but they don't think of it. It doesn't make them angry. They think, well, I guess Roger Ailes was pretty clever, huh, when he showed, the Willie Horton and the rapist and those, you know, isn't that wonderful? They sure did, you know, did a number on old Dukakis. Well, you know, that they did a number. They did an unethical thing using sex and racism in a really ugly way to make dogs salivate. You know, and it's something that people should be angry about, not have this sense of, you know, I guess that's one on them. And I think people are so used to this one-upsmanship, this gamesmanship, that they've really lost sight of what information is all about, which is supposedly, you know, to give you enough of a sense of where you stand in the world and how things work in the world so that you can make an intelligent and ethical decisions. You know, it's not all a game of power. You know, that's one of the things that bothers me a lot. This is another whole area we could get into. But I've been in trouble a couple of times in the last year talking about some of the new theories and criticism criticism of literature, because as you know, the more radical forms of the new postmodern criticism claims that everything is power, that there's not a single poem or a short story, a song, whatever, that was ever written that was based on anything other than one group or one group trying to get the best of another group. And I find that grossly cynical. It throws away the whole idea of pure aesthetics and, you know, the pure impulse to art, which, you know, if I didn't believe in that, I mean, to me that's almost like a religion, the idea that somebody could get up in the morning and have a thought that would force them to sit down and write something beautiful that has absolutely nothing to do with their ethnic group or their income or the place where they were brought up or how they felt about their parents. And I'm deeply offended by this idea that everybody has an angle.
You know, it's funny. I think that from what you're saying and from other things that I've thought myself and read, we are in a nation that is at once cynical, your words, we're watching the game, and also wanting the world to be black and white. These people are right, so these people are wrong. These people are good, mm-hmm. so these people are bad. We seem continually to be jockeying between right, wrong, bad, good. We don't seem to be paying attention to what I think of as the gray areas, perhaps what you'd think of as depth. Mm-hmm. Is that accurate in your mind, and how are we getting here?
It certainly seems to be. It's as if people are so frightened by what they see happening in the world in general. I mean, you know, the breakdown of families and the problems that we're having in this country with crime and young people and racial disputes, and the economy is in just terrible trouble. I mean, you know, there's the funniest thing in America that's going on right now is the stuff about, well, the recovery is faltering or the recovery is slow. There's no recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And the recovery is a word that comes out of the White House. And each day, you know, they take the recovery's temperature. But there, you know, there is no recovery. But I'm sorry, I got a little bit of a drift from your question. Would you repoint that for me? That last question.
The peculiarity that we are both cynical as a nation,
right,
of consumers and somehow innocent. We want things to be right or wrong, bad, good.
Yeah, I think that there's just a terrible fear that the myth that America is good and America is strong and we are the prince of all peoples and, you know, we are the force for good in the world. The fear that this might not be true or that if it ever was true, that we're losing it and we're adrift and our children will be even more adrift than we are. It triggers in most people, or in too many people anyway, not the idea, well, God, let's get out and do something about this. You know, let's get together and try hard to turn it around so that the next generation will have a different attitude and a different chance. More, they just want to shut up the people who tell them the truth, to sort of take away the people who say the subtle things and the things that plague them, and to, you know, give them the clearest, easiest thing that they can hang on to. And I think that was a secret, of course, of the success of Ronald Reagan and the people who've come after him, is that they didn't ask people to deal with complicated ideas of how do we get this done. They said, you know, it's morning in America, you know, just a wonderful slogan, you know, that you see the sun rising. And it wasn't anything. It was a gesture. And it did very well, didn't it?
It did. Are there strong voices in this nation that aren't being heeded as far as you're concerned?
You mean the voices of prophets crying out in the wilderness, or you mean groups that are being ignored?
I'm thinking about within the Fourth Estate.
Well, I think that Yeah, I think the fact that that people's habits now have turned more and more to three or four basic sources for all their information mean that the best information, the people who are trying the hardest to do serious commentary, who are trying the hardest to get real stories and you know, embarrass the evil, the people out there who are trying to deliberately trying to do dishonest things, there are a lot of people out there, and most of them are publishing in small magazines, you know, in obscure places where 600, 1,000, 2,000 people will read what they're writing. And I you know, I'm carried by a lot of publications in the alternate press. And if you had a, well, the Utney Reader makes an attempt, along with a lot of straight media, but they make an attempt to screen the best from all these alternate papers. But if you had all these papers in front of you, you would be astonished by the number of stories that you would find. Some of them, yes, are not done entirely professionally. Some of them are a little off the wall. There are a lot of strange conspiracies and one-sided things about the environment and so forth, yes. But they're young people who really care, who are doing stories that you will never read about in your establishment media. And in many cases, the story will run for years in what we call alternative publications, and then just because it can't be buried anymore, all of a sudden you'll find it in Time Magazine or the New York Times. And you sort of wonder, well, you know, didn't those big media, didn't they have the resources? Didn't they have the sources out there to find out what was going on? And, you know, the answer is that they were looking the other way. They were eating out of the hand of the Washington spin doctors. They were going to lunch at the White House. This is a terrible problem. Russell Baker, who's a real cranky old veteran, I was fortunate after reading him for many years to have dinner with him in Virginia last year. And he apparently has alienated an awful lot of his colleagues in Washington, D.C. by saying, you know, you guys are not what I call journalists anymore. He said, you're just down there, you know, eating lunch with power. And every year you get a little fatter and a little less effective. And apparently he said that at meetings of, you know, not only inside the New York Times, but at gatherings of journalists at like the Gridiron Dinners and so on. And they don't want to listen to that. That's a voice that it's troubling to them. He's old enough and prominent enough to say what he pleases without worrying about himself, but no one's flocking to his banner.
I want to take a bit of a left turn, not too far, though. You mentioned in another forum that there was a vast difference between the way Vietnam was covered, for example, and wars before it, and the brief war in the Persian Gulf. Can you look at that coverage for us and the difference it has meant for the media?
Well, yeah, the story of what happened in Vietnam is a real cautionary tale. Most people today, in my opinion, at the highest levels of the government and the Pentagon and the White House and so forth, believe that we lost the war in Vietnam, and we did lose it, mainly because we couldn't control the press. Because the press kept bringing out these negative stories, you know, kept interviewing these soldiers and kept showing things that they shouldn't have shown to help the American war effort. In other words, these people don't think, well, we were doing the wrong thing. We made a big mistake over there. They think our big mistake was letting these journalists run loose. I mean, this is shocking. I've heard this, you know, from people who were there, from generals and so forth. They said, well, if we hadn't done this, if we hadn't done that. And the enemy that they have picked on is the press. And in the last 20 years, leading up to the war in the Middle East, the government has been trying to figure out how to make sure that won't ever happen again. And what you had in Kuwait was a war orchestrated totally to feed to the media. I mean, I think I said the other night in class that they made up their strategy for spoon-feeding, for distracting, for streamlining the media message long before they figured out what they were going to do to Saddam Hussein. As if, because they knew they could beat Saddam Hussein. I mean, there was never any question. All that stuff about the wonderful fighting men of the Republican Guard and so on, that was a lot of garbage, like all the garbage they made up before they went into Panama. They knew perfectly well they could steamroller the Iraqi army in no time. But the most important thing in the minds of the people in Washington was, how can we sell this questionable action to the people back in the United States? And the lesson they supposedly learned was Vietnam. And what they've done ever since is attract, train, and organize huge teams of effective spin doctors, public relations experts, in order to turn the major media exactly in whatever direction they want them to look. And it worked beautifully. And there are only a few people who sort of threw monkey wrenches into that. They were horrified, of course, when Peter Arnett decided to stay in Baghdad. That was one thing that nobody thought would happen. So they practically tried to, you know, to write him off as a traitor. I mean, there was all this ridiculous right-wing stuff saying that, you know, he was no different than someone who was in Hitler's bunker during World War II. But there were also a lot of people who tried very hard, and some of them broadcast journalists, too. I don't want to give the impression that I don't respect a lot of broadcast journalists. I just want you to know that the best people are not getting the support they should, and their faces and their stories and their talent are becoming a smaller and smaller part of the overall package. But some of them, both print and broadcast journalists, tried very hard to get away from the straight news feed, from the things that were being handed out to them, and to try to get out and find out what the real story was. And I've talked to some of them. And, you know, there were things going on over there that we knew nothing about, and these stories came out months later. It turned out that most of the people who died in the war in the Middle East, American soldiers were killed by their own troops, you know, by what they call friendly fire, which would have been a horrible scandal if we'd known about it in the middle of this wonderful flag-waving yellow ribbon nonsense, you know, last winter. I mean, it might have made a difference then, but 4 months later, after the 74th parade of General Schwarzkopf, nobody really seemed to care. And then the story came out that all the bombs didn't really work, that we were getting this story that, you know, every time they sent up a Scud, we sent up a Patriot bang. Of course, it turned out that a lot of Scuds fell. A lot of Patriots blew up on the launching pad, went off in the wrong direction, screwed up terribly. I mean, the percentage was really low. We didn't know that. I mean, they really did a job. I mean, from their point of view, it was one of the most successful wars in history.
What happens in a situation like this, and I don't think we can limit it to Kuwait. I think I'm trying to use this as an exemplary situation. What happens when to be a patriot is to support the action of the country, and to investigate the various realities of the action of that country is to be unpatriotic?
This is exactly what you were saying before. This is, you know, the simple message kind of stupidity that eats away at a democracy. Obviously, if you love your country, you want your country to be moral. You don't want your country to be hypocritical. And, you know, a simple-minded, brainless patriotism just says, well, my country couldn't do anything wrong, and that's not helpful. And unfortunately, there are a great many people who are simply in denial, who simply refuse to see the reality, which is that this country, over the past 40 years, has used the Cold War and the specter of communism, etc., to do a great many seriously immoral and unethical things in this world. A long, long list. It would be very difficult, very, very difficult, for instance, to differentiate between the ethics of the CIA and the KGB. Basically, they're two of a kind. They're just, you know, two chess players facing each other across the board that was the world. And you can't choose the United States morally in that confrontation. We used supposedly the ever-present danger of Joe Stalin and his successors to do dreadful things in this world. And to say that is to care about your country, not to despise your country. If you want your country to be worthy of admiration and pride, then you want people to know the truth. The opposite, in my mind, of sensible patriotism is just to say my country right or wrong. I mean, I think that's the attitude of morons who don't deserve to live in a country that has a democratic government. I mean, I'd say that anywhere you want me to.
This is Hal Crowther. You're listening to Conversations. I'm your host, Susan McGinnis. Hal Crowther, we've mentioned, has written for Time and for Newsweek. He went to Hollywood for 4 or 5 years on something of a dare and wrote TV movie scripts and big screen movie scripts. He's written on the media for the Buffalo Evening News and for the Toronto Star, and now writes, as we've mentioned, for a weekly column. It is called Hal Crowther, just the name, and that's based, his home and his newspaper, The Independent Weekly, are based in Durham, North Carolina. We have in this country another source of news, the public, non-commercial media, both radio and television. It's held up sometimes to a higher standard, and sometimes it's held on a higher platform. What's your opinion? Do you think such agencies as National Public Radio or Public Broadcasting, McNeil Lear and others, do a better job of reflecting the world to this country?
I think they do insofar as, you know, they have the resources to do it. I think with the limited resources that they have, those people give you a more balanced, more intelligent reflection of reality. But if you had people running CBS News, as you once did, who had the, you know, the sort of political breadth of some of the people on the public and with the resources of a commercial network, you would see a much more impressive brand of news. The problem for the public media, of course, so-called public media, is that they've always had a tremendous problem with money from the very beginning. I mean, I remember back when they were first putting, you know, sort of new experimental programs on public television back in the late 60s and 70s. They were trying some wonderful things. There was a thing called the Great American Dream Machine, which is of sainted memory, which was really cutting edge, original use of video, you know, something that had never been done before. No one watched it, and there was no money forthcoming for anything like that. They used to have people like Nam June Paik, you know, doing showing video art. I mean, you know, making do you know what experimental video is, where you actually, the images on the screen, it's not information, it's actually like paintings and sculpture and so forth, amazing things that used to be on public television. But all these new things that were different from commercial television didn't get the support of your local public television manager, who was much more interested for some reason in British comedies. I've never quite understood why so many people in the United States of America fall down and roll over every time they hear a British accent, but God knows they do. I come from a family where my family came from England not very many generations ago, and there were people still living when I was a boy who had English accents, and we had pictures of the Queens all around. And for some reason, that inoculated me against Anglophilia for life. And I do not understand exactly what the fascination of some of this material is, except that I think it may be cheaper. I think that they may get very good deals on this stuff from the BBC. And when they turned, a few years ago, they decentralized public broadcasting, and they turned much of the decision-making over to the local managers, where it, more of it had been done originally in Washington at the Center for Public Broadcasting and in New York. And unfortunately, most of the choices they made, most of the shows that they chose to fund, were not the ones that you or I might choose, not the ones that were inventive and challenging and politically sophisticated and opened up, you know, worlds to people who were used to commercial television. There's still a few. I mean, I'm not just dismissing public. I mean, that controversial one that was done about the black gays and so on, that is just...
Tongues untied.
Yeah. But, of course, you saw the reaction of many of the local managers when this went out on the network feed. Basically, they have had so little money, and the government has never shown much interest in them because they immediately were plugged as left wingers, as, you know, because of the few really challenging shows that they did back in the 60s and 70s. The government, when the Republicans were elected, said, well, these guys are our enemies, and we're going to shut them down as much as we can, or limit them, tie one arm behind their backs. So at that point, they had to start groveling for money to the corporations. And obviously, although, again, there are some corporations that do give money to worthwhile projects, one should never overlook them. I could even list, you know, a few socially responsible corporations that you know, that we should all recognize, because there are so many that are so irresponsible. But when you're going to corporations hat in hand, you're going to end up seriously softening the political and creative quality of the things that you're doing. And they have. It's, some of the stuff is pretty sorry. And I think sorriest of all, you know, are these six-day begathons, the most boring television. And, you know, I worked on them because it's a good cause, right? I mean, we need something beside the commercial networks. But why do they have to beg like homeless people in the street, you know? I mean, there's something seriously wrong with that, you know, I mean, and what it says about us as a people.
Before we leave the world of journalism too far behind, the picture you paint is dour and dire regarding free press in this United States. Is it all? Doer, to use the Scott term, and Dyer, in your mind? Should young people thinking about becoming journalists become MBAs instead?
Well, they are, apparently. A great many of them. I don't know. I couldn't tell you exactly whether enrollment in journalism schools is down. Certainly the number of jobs available is down. And I can't see how that trend will turn around. But what we have, essentially, in my opinion, is we have a culture here that does not appreciate what the free press is supposed to do, okay, and does not give it their support. Traditionally, ever since the 60s anyway, and I can't go back too well before that, but because I was young and not plugged in and I maybe haven't read all the books, but since I first became involved with the media, the reaction of the majority of the American people has always been to support the politicians, even criminal politicians like Spiro Agnew, for God's sake, against the press. In other words, the thing that they have never recognized, that there was a sacred calling out there, that these people were trying to help them rather than trying to rub mud into their flag. And as long as people out there are not supporting the best work that journalists can do and are not putting their money and their attention behind it, I think it's going to become sadder and sicker. And I think there'll be a time when we will have something very much like state media, where the government will control the important flow of news, the major stories and so on, in a very direct way, very much the way it was done in the Soviet Union, unless we can educate another whole generation of people to understand what it means to have a free flow of information, what it's all about, what freedom of speech is. In this country, we have tremendous ignorance of freedom of speech. I mean, the right-wing politicians manipulate this ignorance all the time. And I see the situation getting worse all the time.
When you say we do not support the free press, we don't know what it means in this country, I'm reminded of something, again, Ben Bagdikian wrote in Media Monopoly. He was actually quoting the losing side, the attorney for the Sacco Vanzetti case. But he said that the whole purpose of the mass media is to point out weaknesses in society's fabric. Mm-hmm. How can you love a guy who's always walking around saying, this isn't working, that's not good, and that's ugly?
And that's the most important guy that you've got. People say to me sometimes, why don't you say more things that are complimentary? Why don't you pick out people who are worthy of praise in your column instead of always finding people who are crooked and hypocritical and ugly?
Give us the good news.
Yeah, well, I said there's thousands of people out there who are doing public relations, who are running chambers of commerce, who are telling you happy stories to make you feel good. I said, but that, there are only a few people who are trying to tell you things that don't make you feel good that are important. And it's a terribly important job. And as you said, I only write once a week. And I really don't have time to tell you about, a woman who's done a wonderful job of reorganizing, the school district in Illinois and so on. I mean, someone else will do that. Her story will be told. As a matter of fact, there are probably 20 network crews looking for her. But there are other stories to be told that will not be told unless I tell them. Mm. And I take it seriously as a responsibility. I really do. I try not to sound pompous, but I do.
I want you to take aim at television for children in this country.
If there's one single thing that the networks, the commercial television networks, have done that is beyond unethical, beyond irresponsible, and actually in the area of criminal activity, it's allowing corporations, commercial interests, to sell products to children under the age of 5 on Saturday morning television. This is so despicable and has gone on for so long that, I mean, it comes to me, it's right up with Nazis experimenting with children and twins and so on in the death camps. I mean, I just cannot believe that a country that supposedly has ideals as high as ours is turning 3-year-olds over to hucksters who have whole programs that are shaped basically to get them to buy a certain line of toys or cereals or candy. It's simply unbelievable. What it does is it starts taking these minds before they're even formed. I mean, before they're even certain of anything, of mom or dad or their sexuality, or, you know, with the sun, when the sun comes up and when it goes down, and they're teaching them how to be consumers in this you know, frenzied consumer society. And it's just dreadful. It's a kind of inoculation. Kind of, you know, we're going to take you out and we're going to make you one of us now. A horrible initiation of the innocent. And it just makes my skin crawl. I mean...
Is this a situation where they truly know not what they do?
I just think that they're, you know, that most of these people are essentially devoted to profit at a point where, that, you know, they are able to justify almost anything to themselves, and we have not forced them to stop.
It's a market.
Well, at one time, when I first became a media critic, I mean, I can go through it. I could write books about this, but the FCC at one time, the Federal Communications Commission, was actually in the business of you know, say, policing broadcasting. I mean, it actually did seek out people sometimes who had licenses, broadcasting licenses, who were irresponsible, and suspended their licenses for certain practices. And it was important. There was a man named Nicholas Johnson back in the 60s who was a real activist FCC commissioner. And he was angry, and he made trouble, and he embarrassed people, and he was good at publicity. He got his face out there. You know, he had a talent for public relations. But when Mr. Nixon came into office, the whole attitude of Republicans, both the good and bad Republicans. I mean, there are some Republicans that are, you know, the Jesse Helms wing of the party are a bunch of people that I think, you know, ought to be living in a fascist country. But there's also a lot of very well-meaning and in many ways enlightened Republicans. But both sides of the Republican Party has always believed that less regulation is better than more. And essentially what they did is they gutted many of these regulation agencies. The EPA is another incredibly important one that lost a lot of its teeth and didn't do much good over the years. And they just allowed these businessmen to run wild. And the FCC barely, as far as I can see, barely exists anymore. All those years I spent, you know, telling people to support their FCC commissioner and get out there and tell them about children's television, tell them about the things that made them angry. There's no point in that at all anymore because they have no teeth. They've had their teeth pulled.
What's the answer? If the FCC can't help, whether one is opposed to or in support of regulation?
I think, you know, pressure. I mean, the people who have had success, some of them are you know, crazy fundamentalists who don't want to hear words on prime time that refer to, you know, sexual acts and so on. And some of them are very responsible parents groups and citizens groups that have brought pressure on broadcasters. And broadcasters are in the business of pleasing you, you know, and as cheaply as they can. And they respond to grassroots fury. I mean, this is something I think that where you can influence them. It's harder on the network level, but you can make your local station respond to a certain extent. I really believe that you can. I don't think there's any local station manager who will ignore a large number of angry people and petitions and pickets and so forth. And if there are enough people across the country, maybe even they would hear you on Sixth Avenue in New York.
And on Sixth Avenue, they're very concerned about the bottom line. They've always said about grassroots efforts, if you take your dollar away from
That's right.
the company.
Boycotting products, boycotting sponsors is a very direct way to bring influence against the network. The networks respond fairly quickly to something like a sponsored boycott. If no one, say, bought a light bulb from General Electric because of something offensive on NBC, I don't think it would be too long before they would be forced to deal with it. There are things that people can do. I mean, we're not helpless consumers just chained in our chairs watching commercials and picking up the phone to order what we've just seen on the screen. I mean, we do still have rights and avenues and protection. It's not too late for us to assert ourselves as thinking human beings, but a lot of people choose not to.
A lot of people just say to parents, for heaven's sakes, monitor what your child is watching.
This is, I think, generally a specious argument. I mean, I believe... I've told people that I think the television should be removed from the home, or at least removed from the children's access. I mean, I just don't think that children should be allowed to watch any television instead of it being used as a babysitter the way it is for so many people. You almost have to be an adult to be able to sort it out, to understand exactly, you know, what's going on in the commercials and the programs and so forth. So, I mean, to watch all this violence and sexuality and hard sell and fast cuts and everything when you're a child, I think it's liable to make you psychotic. I mean, I think it's actually harming the you know brain functions of young people. And I think it's very dangerous. But to imagine that you can have that television in your home and to have all the you know television in all the homes of the friends of your children, and to think that there are certain things in there that you can keep them from seeing, that you know everyone I know who tried has failed. There's sex shows on at night. I mean, what's to keep your child from getting up at 11:30 at night and going on and you know down and plugging in those late movies with all the naked bodies in them? Lots of them do it. You can't you know guard your children night or day. If you put that machine down there, and it's got that stuff available, they will get to it.
Are you ever going to watch TV again?
I mean, as a habit, I doubt it very much. I mean, I've been very happy for the last 15 years away from it.
Would something have to happen before you said, ooh, I think I'll tune this in? What time is it?
Well, I watch. You know, people will recommend. People told me about Ken Burns' Civil War series and so forth and said, you know, there's some really wonderful things happening here. And I tuned in a couple of them, and I was very impressed. I mean, I take recommendations. But I literally cannot watch commercial television. Mm-hmm. I mean, it drives me crazy now. I mean, after all those years when I had to watch this stuff for a living, although, come to think of it, a television critic never has to watch a situation comedy or a drama with commercials. See, we always got tapes right from the source. So even when I was a television critic, I never had to watch commercials. And I never watched these shows on my own time. I only did it because I was working. But when I see a show now, And you know, right in the middle of what is supposedly the thrust of the plot, they just turn immediately to a commercial. It just drives me crazy. And if I'm watching a good movie, say, which I will do now and then late at night, say the ball game will go off and I don't feel like going to bed, so I'll sit there with my channel switcher, and I'll find a good movie, and then you know 4 minutes later, bang, and you know I'll take the first one, and then within three commercials I go to bed. I just can't bear it. It's a habit that you get into. It's like living in Mexico City and breathing toxic air. You know, if you live there long enough, it doesn't feel to you, I guess, like toxic air. It may be killing you slowly, but you can breathe it, and you know you're not uncomfortable. And it's the same thing, I think, with people who watch television that's larded with commercials all the time. And I think the paper yesterday said that they're adding more commercials and more commercial time all the time. I mean, there's a curve that goes up. So more and more of your television is being eaten up by commercials. But you get used to it so that you don't notice it at all. But it's doing something serious to your mind, I really believe.
Last question. Given what you've said in the last hour,
have I been talking for an hour?
You have. Is the democracy absolutely ill-fated in this country? Will it take another country to create the next stage of democracy?
It will take a chastening in this country. It will take a hard times and failure and a basic reassessment of who we are and what we stand for. I think that obviously, as far as war goes, we're the most powerful country in the world, and I think even with the leftovers from our ridiculous buildup, we will still be the most powerful country in the world militarily 50 years from now. But what will happen to us, what is happening to us right now, is that our economy is not geared to compete with a lot of other peaceful, you know, peacetime economies in this world. We will suffer. Middle-class people will suffer. And when middle-class people begin to see that the way we do things in this country is not effective, when they begin to understand that the politicians of the 80s made the rich richer and the poor poorer in a very direct way. I mean, you could quote statistics all day long. What happened is that the wealthiest 2% of people in the United States became enormously wealthy, and people at the bottom end of the middle class started dropping lower, and the really poor people almost dropped off the map during the end. Just a terrible, shocking thing, but people don't see it that way. It's going to take a lot of suffering and a lot of rethinking. And if this country is truly humiliated, so that it has to turn to a different kind of politician and a different kind of thinking in order to get it back on its feet, you know, just economically, there is a chance that people will begin to regain some of the old values that are worthwhile and get rid of some of the things that have poisoned us. I mean, there's always a chance. I mean, there are new people being born and educated every moment. You know, the old people are dying off. I don't think we've poisoned the culture so much that it can never be purified again. But I'll tell you that it's getting more toxic every minute.
Hal Crowther, thanks for your thoughts.
Enjoyed it. Thank you, Susan.
You've been listening to Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. I hope you'll join me again next week.